Music, people don't understand this. It's a very difficult thing. Everybody associates playing music with proficiency, techniques. It has nothing to do with that. I mean, that's very secondary. What's most important in playing music is the set of ears you develop. If what you hear inside your head is very, very good, you will spend your life and all of your efforts trying to duplicate that sound. You'll never do it, but you'll at least try to approximate it. And if you keep sharpening your hearing, what you do will get better, because you'll force yourself to. You won't be able to stand being worse than that sound. I mean, imagine how well Heifetz hears. When we hear what he does, he can't do what he really hears. Mm-hmm. Nobody can, but he hears awfully good. So that's what it's about.
Artie Shaw, the man and his music. Presented tonight on a one-night stand with the big band. Brought to you by the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut. With authentic early American reproductions to beautify your home. And by Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground, Bristol, offering fun for the whole family since 1846. Good evening, this is Arnold Dean. Welcome to a one-night stand with Artie Shaw. That's one of the 8 million sellers of the Artie Shaw Orchestra. It's known as Back Bay Shuffle. It's a relative rarity to be able to gain an interview with Artie Shaw in 1971, but after about 6 weeks of telephone calls, we were able to establish a connection with him, and he invited us to bring our WTIC microphones to his sumptuous West 58th Street apartment, some 22 stories above Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. We found Artie Shaw to be a warm, friendly, humorous, and, as any music fan knows, gifted man. But he's gifted not only musically, also with an intellect, an outstanding intellect, and the ability to articulate it. We'll prove that to you as we introduce the man, Artie Shaw, in just a moment. If we were to name Artie Shaw's key to success, it would probably be his perfectionism. Shaw chose only the best men to accompany him, so he consequently had one of the finest groups of musicians ever assembled. He was a maestro who upheld a strict degree of integrity in his music and insisted on the ultimate in performance. Now, this same standard of perfection was the greatest asset of a man who preceded Shaw by over a century. That man was Lambert Hitchcock. Hitchcock also insisted on superb performance in design and workmanship. As a result, the original Hitchcock craftsman produced a line of masterfully decorated furniture with the simple elegance that was to become a classic American style. To this day, Hitchcock's legacy of quality design and manufacturing has been preserved. You can see his exquisite line of furniture at the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut. The showroom displays hundreds of authentic early American reproductions in a variety of lovely colors and finishes. The traditional Hitchcock beauty has been maintained, yet adapted to contemporary needs. Hitchcock, a legend in American craftsmanship. The Hitchcock Retail Showroom is open Monday through Saturday, 9 to 5, Wednesday evenings till 9. Artie Shaw, born Arthur Arshawsky, on the Lower East Side of New York City, May 23rd of 1910, an only child. And, Artie, how old were you when your family moved to New Haven, Connecticut?
I think about 7.
And I know in your book, The Trouble with Cinderella, which you identified as an outline of identity, you mentioned places that will be familiar to many of our listeners. I'm sure the Dwight Street School, the apartment on Grand Avenue, Hill House High School, and your first contact with music, an early and, I guess, undistinguished effort at learning the piano.
Oh, you mean when I was forced to take, as they say. Yeah, that lady used to show up once a week and make me break my chops on a bunch of notes that had no meaning to me, learn how to move the white keys and the black keys, and it made no sense at all.
You kind of felt the same way about school, didn't you?
No, not when I first got into school. I kind of liked it. I didn't like what happened when I, you know, and the old anti-Semitism thing which was going around. I didn't like that, but in the classes themselves, I was fair to middling. I hesitate to say brilliant, but I was a pretty good scholar. And until I got into the idea of doing something about getting out of where I was and found that the saxophone might be my method of escaping from an environment I didn't like. Once I got into that, I decided that was the only key and everything else was irrelevant, as we say today. It had no meaning. All of school had no meaning to me at all. I couldn't see any relationship between learning what Caesar had to say about Gaul or where Spain was in relationship to Portugal. They had no connection whatsoever with what I thought was important, which was how to manipulate that instrument to make myself $7 million and be surrounded by a bunch of groovy chicks and live in a house with a kidney-shaped swimming pool. That was all I had in mind.
I enjoyed reading of your first contact with the saxophone. It was at the old Poli Theater?
Well, that was where I first heard a guy do it.
I think he played something called Dreamy Melody.
Yeah, I think that was the song. As a matter of fact, I tried to play it when I got my first saxophone. And I found that it was all chromatics, and I didn't know how to do that. I had learned to play a C scale, but I didn't know how to play the B flats and the A flats. So I found I couldn't play Dreamy Melody, and I settled for Charlie My Boy instead.
But when you got your saxophone, I think it took you only a couple of months of practice on your own. I believe you took two relatively informal lessons from the man who sold you the sax.
Yeah, that came with it, as they say. It was a blue plate special, the saxophone and two lessons. I was supposed to take five, but he bored me after the first two. He talked too much.
And a couple of months after that, you were able to win an amateur night, $5 bill.
Yeah, and you can stress amateur. That's the operative word in that sense. It was pretty bad, but you can imagine what the rest of the performers were like. I won $5. My old man couldn't believe it. In those days, $5 was like, really $5. Today, I don't know what that would do. It wouldn't pay for, I don't think it would tip my garage man.
You mentioned in your book that he would invite his card-playing cronies to listen to you play the number, and he'd say, listen to this, for $5 he played that.
I think he did that once or twice.
You
it was
got
like
to hear
a grudging
free.
Concession that all this noise he had to live with was finally paying off. And some he didn't hit a jackpot, but at least he got a couple of lemons.
The big band in New Haven at that time, and I'm sure this is a name that'll ring a few bells in the area, is Johnny Cavaleros. And he had a couple of pretty good musicians with him. Ray Trotta, who I think is still active today.
Is he?
In Texas, yes. We got an album of his recently.
Yeah, well, he had before that Charlie Spivak, and Charlie worked in the band. And I don't remember who, a number of people
Tony
graduated.
Pastrito.
Tony Pastrito died recently, Tony Pastor. Johnny was the first band I played with, oddly enough, at a place called the Cinderella Ballroom. Oddly, in view of the fact that my first book was The Trouble with Cinderella.
Maybe this would be a good time to talk about that book, at least with the title, Artie. After having read it, I've come up with my own conclusions as to why you named it that way, but for those who haven't been able to read it for one reason or another, how did you come up with the title, The Trouble with Cinderella?
Well, I was dealing really with the Cinderella myth that a lot of us are raised with. And I remember that when my band and when I had our first immense popular peak, when we hit that peak, and suddenly from being a loser, I was up to making $15,000 to $30,000 a week overnight, and it was literally overnight. I finished the Lincoln Hotel and went out to the first theater date. I mean, it was not believable, the difference in the amount of money, from the amount of money you lost one week to the amount you made the next week. So. At that point, Variety and all of the trade papers given to these hyperbolic statements started calling me the Cinderella Boy. And I thought, well, what the hell has that got to do with anything Cinderella? I mean, but it made me focus a little more on some of my unspoken and hidden assumptions. We all walk around with those. And I began to realize that I had been going around with the idea that if you did certain things and you worked hard and, you know, all the old cliches about nose to the grindstone and learn a trade and be a good boy and don't get arrested, then one day somebody's going to come around, Uncle Don will hand you $72 million. So I believed all this garbage. And once I got a little older and began to understand that this garbage could be terribly distorting to a human being, and about the time I got to writing my book, I thought the Cinderella thing is really a bunch of a word that could knock us off the air. Mm-hmm. And I thought, let me write about that. So what'll I call it? The Trouble with Cinderella. That
very interesting book, by the way. I enjoyed reading
it
thoroughly.
I hope so. It was probably the only honest book that I'd read up to it. It was the only honest book on that subject I knew. That's why I wrote it. I wrote it because no one else had written it. Mm-hmm. It was that simple.
It was to be about a decade and a half later that Artie Shaw, in 1941, recorded this million seller, Dancing in the Dark.
Thank you.
The sounds of the big bands are returning to the ballroom at Lake Compounds, Bristol. Yes, Saturday, May 1st, Bobby Kay and his 15-piece orchestra will recreate the sounds of the big bands with all the spirit and enthusiasm of the originals. You'll enjoy the music of Glenn Miller, Harry James, Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, and many other greats. Saturday, May 1st, at Lake Compounds. And remember, Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground, opens its 126th fun-filled season this weekend with special Easter festivities. There'll be fun and entertainment for everyone. Sunday, Slim Cox and the Cowboy Caravan will perform on the Midway stage in continuous free shows beginning at 2:30 in the afternoon. Sunday, between 3 and 6 p.m., Colonel Clown, Peter Rabbit, and Deputy Deb will be passing out free ride tickets to children 10 years of age and under. And beginning at 12 noon, you'll be able to have dinner in the dining room overlooking the lake. So join the fun this weekend at Lake Compounds in Bristol as they begin their 126th season. Now let's continue our conversation with Artie Shaw. Artie, we were talking about bands extant at that time in that area. You mentioned Johnny Cavallaro and Barney Rapp. The Yale Collegians were also active in New Haven with a saxophone man named...
Les Layden was the leader of the band. And as a matter of fact, a guy named Frank Cabot, who later became a screenwriter, playwright, and I see him occasionally now. He was the drummer in the band. Mm-hmm. Rudy Vallee was in the band. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, some of whom have been heard from in business, others have been heard from in music, not too many of them. Andy Wiswell, who was later the A&R man for Capitol Records, he played trombone. And I was the ringer, I was the townie. I was the young kid that once in a while they would hire to sit down and, you know, fill in a chair.
And it was a good experience for you because you were self-taught up to this point. You could audition and get a job with the band, but when it came time to read something, you'd never learned how to read.
Well, by the time I was sitting in with the Yale Collegians, I'd learned to read. The first place that I learned the necessity of that was with Johnny Cavallaro. Mm-hmm. I had been called to do an audition for them. Some guy around town heard me play at a little gig. It was either a bar mitzvah or something silly like that. And he said, look, you ought to audition for Cavallaro. Come along. So I packed my horn and went with him. You know, I'll go anywhere to do that. I was a hustler, you know. So I went up there and auditioned, and then they liked what they heard. I played not bad. I mean, I was copying everybody. Mm-hmm. Some of it was pretty good. Some of it was terrible, but I didn't know the difference. If it was on a record, it had to be good. That was my idea, uh-huh. So you copied it. And some of the good stuff must have got to Cavallaro and the rest of the people in the band, so they hired me. Then they stuck me into a chair and said, here, read this. And I knew what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. It looked like, you know, pure Sanskrit or Urdu or Swahili. I couldn't read it, so I said, what am I supposed to do? He said, well, can't you read music? I said, no, I never bothered learning. Do you have to read music? So he said, yeah. So I said, okay, give me a chance, I'll go home. And I went home, and about a month later, I was able to read.
You stayed with Walt Cavallaro and other bands in the area until about the age of 16, I believe?
And as a matter of fact, I ran away from home when I was 15, I believe. I just cut out, and some group of guys came through. I was fired. That's in the book. I was fired by Cavallaro for doing something childish and stupid, which I...
Well, you were only 15.
Well, I was a child, so, you know, I suppose at 15 you can do childish things. Anyway, he didn't take it with good grace, so I cut out of there, and I joined up with some group of guys, and we ended up in Kentucky.
Yes, the Kentuckians, as a matter of fact. They were hopefully named the Kentuckians,
That's
but I guess the job never panned out.
They ended up being the Nowherians.
Uh-huh. And
so,
your horn ended up
nowhere.
In Hawk.
Yeah. So my horns ended up in Hawk, and I finally got them out by auditioning with somebody borrowing horns and worked with that guy for a while and finally got my money out of there and got bus fare and came and showed up in New Haven again. Now I was 15, and I was a very cocky young 15. I was even smoking cigarettes. And there it was. So about a year later, a guy showed up and took me to Cleveland with him. I joined that band. And that's where I stayed till I was 19.
That was Joe Cantor's Far East
Orchestra.
That
was the band. The guy who came to New Haven to get me was a fellow named Charlie Cantor. He'd heard me in Florida. Again, sitting in with some group. You know, in those days, that's what you did. Those were innocent, primitive days where nobody was worrying about you know, Union Scale and Agva and Aftra and any of that. We just went with our horns and sat down somewhere where there were people playing, and hopefully somebody'd hear you, liked what you did, and that would lead to something else.
There was more than a little bravado involved in your learning to double on clarinet, too, wasn't there?
Well, that was all the same thing. It wasn't bravado. It was sheer desperation. I mean, I knew that if I didn't get out of New Haven, I was going to split a gut. So somebody said, you know, you want to go to Florida? I said, sure, I want to go to Florida. Said, can you play clarinet? I said, sure, I can play clarinet. I didn't even have a clarinet. So anyway, I borrowed some money, and I got a clarinet, and I paid it off in installments. And meanwhile, I was in Florida making terrible sounds. But by then, he'd had me down there. It was either fire me and send me back or cast me adrift. He couldn't do that. I was underage, so he'd have been in trouble. He kept me on. By the time I finished, I could produce a few sounds out of it. And I was pretty horrendous. It was pretty bad.
He shuddered every time you took it up.
He and I, both. I was shuddering so bad I had a vibrato before I blew a note.
The novelty vocal by Tony Pastor. That was Artie Shaw, 1938 vintage, with Indian Love Call. You're listening to A One Night Stand with Artie Shaw, the man and the music, being brought to you on 1080 Radio. This is WTIC, Broadcast House in Hartford, Connecticut, and being brought to you by America's Pioneer Playground, Lake Compounds of Bristol, and by the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut. In the early 1800s, a young America was growing, and an enterprising young artisan named Lambert Hitchcock was growing with it. His contribution to an expanding America was the advancement of furniture output methods. From the limited productivity of individual craftsmen to primitive mass production. In 1826, Hitchcock chose a small northern Connecticut settlement as the site for a factory famed for chairs stenciled with his name. Today, the quaint historic factory still stands, nestled on the picturesque banks of the Farmington River. Surviving, too, is Lambert Hitchcock's legacy of quality design and manufacturing. Masterful craftsmen at work in the restored Hitchcock retail showroom adapt the old Hitchcock flavors to authentic modern reproductions. The Hitchcock retail showroom displays 125 styles of furniture, including chairs, tables, benches, mirrors, headboards, and chests. Choose from 13 different finishes and a variety of lovely colors. Visit the showroom and discover the timeless beauty of Hitchcock. Designs of yesteryear for today's homemakers. That's the Hitchcock Retail Showroom, Riverton, Connecticut. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 to 5, Wednesday evenings till 9. When Artie Shaw was with the Joe Cantor Orchestra in Cleveland, he decided to enter the arranging field.
Well, it wasn't really, you make it sound so fancy, enter the arranging field. I want to know how that stuff got written. And I decided the only way to find out, as I've done all my life, I've done this with painting, I've done it with writing, I've done it with everything I've ever tried. The way to find out is do it. And you'll find out how stupid you are. And in correcting your stupidity, you might get to be pretty good.
Your writing was not confined, though, just to arrangements. I read in the book that you won a contest promoting the Cleveland air races in 150
right.
words or less.
That's right. I hadn't the faintest idea. It was 500 words, I think. I don't know. Maybe it was 150. It's a long time ago. I sent the thing in, and a few days later, to my utter astonishment, I was told I won first prize, which was, you know, at the age of 16, rather a brilliant thing, a trip to Paris in one of those tin planes, those Ford tri-motor planes. I don't know how that thing ever got off the ground, I'll never know, but it did, and it got me there. You know, what we did was we leapfrogged hedges. You'd get over one hedge, and then you'd find yourself in St. Louis, and you'd fly over another hedge, and you're Acapulco.
You ended up in Hollywood,
ended up in Hollywood for about a week, I think.
Got to hear Irving Aronson's Commanders. That's
they
still
had to be playing in the hotel where this junket put us up, the Blossom Room of the Hotel Roosevelt, and Irving was playing there, Irving Aronson's band, and Tony Pastrito, and Charlie Trotter, Ray Trotter's brother, were in the band. Well, it was got to be old home week, you know, all us old Connecticut, New Haven, nutmeg staters. And when they came through Cleveland some 6 or 8 months later, they dropped into the joint where I was playing with a band named Austin Wiley, heard me, and there was an empty chair in that band coming up, so they persuaded Irving Aronson to hire me.
When you finally joined the Commanders, Irving Aronson's orchestra, you were sort of disillusioned with it, weren't you?
Well, it was a show band, you know. It was like music was secondary, and music was the only thing I knew anything about. I was still, despite all my present seeming confidence, I was a very introspective and shy kid. And actually, I have an almost psychoanalytic theory about this, that the reason I played a horn was that it was a good thing to hide behind. I could express myself through it, but no one could ever say what I was thinking because that horn was doing it. And the band, the Aronson band, was not in any way interested in that. Music seemed to be secondary. Music was what you played so that people could dance while you were getting ready to do the show. The band put on a show, a floor show. And everybody had other talents. They sang and they danced and they did skits and they did imitations and all of this jazz. And very few of them were good musicians. And that was the only thing I cared about. So I was a loner. I was a maverick freak in that band.
And you even decided to try one number. You sang Dinah, I believe, which led to an unforgettable comment from Aronson.
Something about the personality of a lox.
A dead lox, yeah.
Dead locks, right. Most loxes are dead. I never saw a live lox in my life.
Napoleon marched his men to Waterloo. What did he say to them?
Oh, no, dee-oh, oh, no, no, dee-oh, no.
Oh, is that so? Washington at Valley Forge was bitter cold and up spoke George.
Oh, no, no, oh, no, no, dee-oh, no.
No, you don't say. And Simon Legree in Uncle Tom's cabin. What did he say to Uncle Tom? I'll tell you what he said. He took his whip and said to Uncle Tom, come on.
Charleston.
And in the Senate the other day, What did our President Coolidge say?
Artie, when the Aaronson Band got to Chicago, you were really in the nest of that day's great jazz. You were playing with and listening to musicians like Louis Armstrong, Benny Goodman, Eddie Condon, Gene Krupa, Father Hines, Bix Beiderbecke, Bud Freeman, Jimmy Noon. Who had the greatest influence on you?
What I think is the really proper way to put this is that I was listening to everything I could hear that seemed to me to be of any value, and looking at everything that I thought was of any value. Essentially, the idea, it seems to me, can be summed up in the term a well-stocked mind. If your mind is filled with an awful lot of references, if you read a lot, and you hear a lot, and you look a lot, your taste is bound to improve, because sooner or later you get better criteria and you can eliminate things. So I was listening to everybody. And to this day, everybody has a big influence. I'm being influenced by what I'm doing right here. You're being influenced, and we're influencing each other. What it boils down to is funny. I had a discussion with Benny once about this. And we were sitting having lunch and talking about, he was talking about Reginald Kell. What did I think of Reginald Kell? And I said, well, you know, it's all right. I mean, it sounds nice, I guess. I like what he does. He sounds all right. And Benny said, what do you mean, sounds all right? He's this and that. I said, Benny, look, you know, the trouble with you is you're too hung up on the clarinet. And he looked at me like I was out of my mind. And I said, he said, what are you talking about? That's what we play. I said, I know, Benny, but we're supposed to be playing music. The clarinet's an instrument. It's a means of saying something musically. I mean, I wish I had 17 clarinets so I could say 17 things instead of one. It's a bore, the instrument. I mean, you have to put up with the technique and learn how to do it. But the aim is to get past the clarinet to a musical statement.
Artie Shaw once said, there's no sense in my doing what somebody else is doing. I want to stay up to date musically, but in my own way. And that's what he did for an entire career. And if Artie Shaw can attribute his success to doing his own thing, then Lake Compounce in Bristol can say the same. You see, just as Artie Shaw set his own precedent for music style, Lake Compounce has established its own type of fun and entertainment. And at Lake Compounce, America's pioneer playground, you'll find fun for the entire family. This weekend, Lake Compounce begins its 126th season with special Easter festivities. Sunday, perennial favorite Slim Cox and the Cowboy Caravan will perform on the Midway stage in continuous free shows beginning at 2:30 in the afternoon. Sunday, between 3 and 6 p.m., Colonel Clown, Deputy Deb, and Peter Rabbit will be passing out free ride tickets to children 10 years of age and under. And there's much more this and every weekend at Lake Compounce. So take the whole family to Lake Compounce in Bristol, offering fun and entertainment for people of all ages since 1846. We're interested in Artie Shaw's itinerary, from the Cantor Orchestra in Cleveland to the air trip, which took him to Paris and to California, and an audition with the Aaronson Band, then back east, then joining the Aaronson Band, traveling to Chicago and other hotbeds of the music business of the 1920s. It might all have served as an inspiration for one of his own compositions, which he eventually recorded in 1938. It's called Nonstop Flight. Glenn Miller used to insist that when he was playing his personal appearances, that Tex Beneke, for example, remember the tenor sax solo that he'd played on In the Mood.
Yeah, and the band sounded like a big machine.
Right. Did you give your musicians latitude in playing solos? There was no need them to repeat what was on the record.
Not only that, if a guy would splatter a note all over the opposite wall, I'd say, groovy, try again. You know, they'd look at me first, you know, because the word was that I was a very strict taskmaster. Well, I was, you know. I mean, I wanted people to do their jobs, but that didn't include don't try. The idea is if you never made a mistake, then you weren't trying. I mean, because you're doing what's safe. It's like today we buy handmade things. Why? A machine makes them more slickly, but handmade shows that somebody put effort in it, and you'll see a twist in the warp, or you'll see a piece of cloth with a nub sticking out. That shows it's handmade. And a machine is okay to make plastic, but if you want to make something very real, you don't make it with a machine. You put your hand and your head and your soul to work with that. That's what it's about.
As long as you feel that way about it, your association with the CBS staff in 1930, which was a tremendous financial success, by the way, and you were extremely successful there, but it must have been a terrible drag for you because you were extremely restricted in what you could play.
Oh, you're talking about when I was working as a staff musician
yes.
in radio, yeah. Well, you had to play the commercial product that you were given to play. After all, just as today television is and radio is, essentially a marketing medium. No one is out there looking for your personal idiosyncrasies. They put the notes up there, and if it's Rinso White, you play Rinso White. And don't give me any embellishments, and I don't want to hear about the shape of your nose in there. Just play the music, play the notes. So, sure, I mean, you become part of the machine. I mean, you're a cog in it. Remember that hit parade thing?
Yes.
Probably the Lucky Strike program in those days. And you'd play the same tune over and over and over, week after week after week, and go through the motions of rehearsing because it was a cost-plus thing for the agency and all that jazz. And at one point, somebody tried to do something a little different just to break the monotony of the monotony for us, the musicians, that is. And somebody said, why don't we just, you know, leave everything out and let the rhythm section and Shaw play like 16 bars there. And I played fairly close to the melody. I wasn't going to offend anybody by doing something like playing any real jazz in that. So I played it, but then the voice of God came from the sponsor's booth, the control room. And he said, hey, what's that? And I said, the conductor said, what do you mean, what's that? It's a clarinet solo. The guys were paying for 30 men. What do you got there, five guys playing? Cut it out. So, okay, stick those strings and trumpets in. Well, I dare say that most of the big name band leaders of the late 30s, that is the original wave, the first wave, came right out of that. Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller, myself. That was it. We were the first four, and we were the ones who sort of established it. After that, the second wave were our alumni. Just like today, we're dealing with the sons of the big movie stars, and they're all going out and doing it. They're either directors or they're actors. So that's how life works. But yeah, they were good men in that band, but the medium did not allow for it. I mean, there was no room. And if you wanted to play the kind of music you wanted to play, you had to go out on one-night stands in those days. And,
yes.
You know, blast out in barns and in ballrooms around the country.
And Artie Shaw did his share of that over 30 years ago. Not in the confines of a recording studio, but live in the famous ballrooms where the clarinet virtuoso and his band thrilled thousands. That same sense of a bygone day recaptured is experienced each time you visit the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut. Yes, the Hitchcock Retail Showroom recreates the flavor of colonial America with a delightfully quaint atmosphere and authentic reproductions of the era. Their vast display includes chairs, tables, benches, headboards, chests, lamps, china, glass, and beautiful gift items, and all at attractive prices. Grace your home with some of history's richest designs from the Hitchcock Retail Showroom. Stop in. And the warm charm of early America will welcome you. The showroom is open Monday through Saturday from 9 till 5, Wednesday evenings till 9. Artie Shaw, 1939. A vocal from Helen Forrest in the beautiful All the Things You Are.
of a lovely song. You are the angel glow that lights a star. The dearest things I know are what you are. Someday my happy arms will hold you, and things you are mine.
In 1935, someone was promoting a swing concert at the Imperial Theater in New York. They had a lineup that included Bunny Berrigan, the Casaloma Orchestra, Bob Crosby, and you were invited, and you wanted to do something a little bit different, and you sure did.
Well, yeah, it was a, you see, swing concert today sounds like nothing. In those days, it was a very daring idea, because swing was a, like the word jazz, not a highly respectable term. No one understood what that was all about. Now, the swing concert was done by musicians for musicians, and they invited to that concert most every big band that was within range, as you mentioned, and Tommy Dorsey and whoever was around. So Joe Helbach, who promoted this thing, he was the guy who ran a place called the Onyx Club, a hangout for jazz musicians. Joe promoted this thing. They rented the Imperial Theater, and I was asked, among other people, to do a gig, do a little thing. I heard that everybody was going to use a rhythm section, you know, meaning a bass, a piano, a guitar, and a drum, and play with that. So I thought, well, yeah, it's going to sound awfully monotonous after about six of those, even though the guy in front of it does something different from the last guy. So I thought, well, I'll write something. I wrote something for a string quartet. The string quartet and clarinet was a sound that had been used by, you know, a lot of people from Mozart on up. And I thought, well, I'll write something for clarinet and strings. And then in order to give it a little beat, I'll have a guitar and a bass and a drum. Leave out piano, because the piano would just muddy it up. And I wrote a piece. And we played it. And to my utter astonishment and chagrin and everything else, nervousness, it just broke up the joint. All right, end of story. The next day, I was asked if I would form a band. Agencies started calling and recording companies. And next thing I knew, I was doing that. And I gave up school, which I was going to Columbia at the time, taking courses in literature. I gave up school because the idea was, if you make enough money with a band, you'll then be able to support yourself to write. I didn't realize the trap I was heading into.
You kept strings in that first band, didn't you?
First band, right. It was based on a similar orchestration to the thing that busted up that concert. Mm-hmm. But in order to give it a little more scope, I added a couple of trumpets and a trombone and a tenor saxophone. That's Enter Tony Pastor now. Mm-hmm. open at the Hotel Lexington, where, I mean, nobody showed up but musicians. Musicians were interested in it. They thought it was a very interesting sound. But the public was then getting conditioned to that thing called swing, which consisted of, you know, very loud six brass and four reeds and four rhythm combinations. So the band didn't last too long. And when I broke it up, everybody told me I was out of my mind, but I figured it wasn't going to work, so I did break it up eventually.
With that band, you had a book, Artie, of 40 of your own arrangements. Where at this point, were you still writing out laboriously every note all by yourself, or would you come up with an arrangement idea and pass it on to someone else?
For a while there, the only way I could get the pattern of the band established was to write it all. Mm. So I was working at CBS and at NBC and doing freelance radio work during the day, and then at night I would go home and write arrangements. And then when I got enough of them together so that I could say, that's the style of the band I'm aiming at, then we put the band together. Those little dots on paper, you go snowblind from looking at all that paper. Anyway, it got done, and then the band started. And as I told you, it fell apart. So it was goodbye to that, and goodbye to the book, and goodbye to the records of that band. And then along came a new band that I started called Art Shaw and His New Music.
You'll enjoy the music of Glenn Miller, Harry James, Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, and many other greats, Saturday, May 1st at Lake Compounds. Yes, Saturday, May 1st, Bobby Kay and his 15-piece orchestra will recreate the sounds of the big bands with all the spirit and enthusiasm of the originals. Call Lake Compounds for details. And remember, Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground, begins its 126th fun-filled season with a special Easter Sunday program. Sunday afternoon between 3 and 6, Colonel Clown, Deputy Deb, and Peter Rabbit will be passing out free ride tickets to children 10 years of age and under. There'll be free Easter candy and souvenirs, too. Plus, continuous free entertainment beginning at 2:30 p.m. Sunday with Slim Cox and the Cowboy Caravan. Yes, there's fun for the whole family this and every weekend at Lake Compounds. That's Lake Compounds, Bristol. Open weekends during April and May with special reduced rates on all rides each Saturday afternoon from 1 to 6. Continue to chart the history of Artie Shaw, the man and the music, the recording of Begin the Begin, which changed his life, and the price of his tremendous success and a grave illness driving him away from show business, then his triumphal return with Frenesy. On our next one-night stand with the big bands, Thursday, May 6th at 9:05. Tonight's program has been brought to you by Lake Compounds, America's pioneer playground, Bristol, offering fun for the whole family since 1846. And by the Hitchcock Retail Showroom in Riverton, Connecticut, with authentic early American reproductions to beautify your home. Our location engineer was Ted Broussard, our recording engineer Bob Schirago. Our program was produced by Brian Hartnett. This is Arnold Dean. Do join us again Thursday, May 6th at 9:05 for another one-night stand with Artie Shaw and his orchestra on WTIC Radio.